Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland Family Charitable Fund. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life.
Remember the misery that was adolescence?
Everybody keeps on looking at me or thinking about me, and I feel like whenever I walk into a room, someone just is staring at me.
Being a teen and feeling like you're the center of the universe is hard. I'm not being sarcastic. I'm Maiken Scott, and this is The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation.
You measure a sample, but you measure millions and billions of molecules all at the same time.
You get to see these patients over and over again. They become part of your family.
It's a virus that likes to attack lots of different organ systems.
You know, everything falls apart.
How about a bag of frozen peas to keep you comfy? Plus,
bingo.
So here's this population that never gets studied.
Pretty much all of cell biology needs to kind of be redone.
I first opened a little box
before and there was a cell.
All of the surgeries that have prior to
1946. We're just getting some of the medicine through your IV.
Basically, we wanted to know if there was any point to doing it.
On today's show, More Than Meets the Eye, we'll peel back some layers of our daily lives to discover what's underneath. A small bird's migration pattern that illustrates a big problem, a few design tweaks on a food label that are supposed to change our behavior, and the important NASA computers that were people, and women at that. But let's start with adolescence and a psychological concept related to that time period that is morphing and changing in this age of social media. There's a scene that's frozen in my memory, and it pops into my head often. I don't know why. I'm 16 years old, and I'm meeting a friend in a cafe. The cafe has big windows, and as I'm looking for a place to lock up my bike, I can see people sitting at tables, drinking coffee, chatting, and I feel like everybody is staring at me, assessing me. Everybody at the cafe, they are paying attention to what I'm doing. I'm praying I won't drop my bike lock or my keys. And I'm walking toward the cafe's glass door, and the whole time I'm thinking, is this a push or a pull door? What if I push and it's really pull? I'm feeling panicked over the possibility of making a fool of myself. My entire adolescence was a long string of such moments. And when I brought this up to Philadelphia high school senior Amanda Thu, she knew immediately what I was talking about.
Let's say my seat is across the room. I would have to make this way in order to get to my seat without getting noticed as much.
She's scared of stumbling, of pushing on a pull door, of being judged.
I feel like they would judge me on my body mostly. Like, who does she think she is walking in the room like that? Or, wow, what is she wearing today?
11-year-old Helena Savin is worried about saying something stupid because, in her mind, mistakes will not be forgotten.
I feel like whatever I'm going to say is going to be, like, in everyone's minds all the time.
Her friend Sinai Miller agrees. She's constantly thinking that she'll embarrass herself.
Just, like, small things. So I just feel, like, very cautious of what I'm doing.
Of course, adolescents are often brutal toward each other in their judgment and teasing, but this exaggerated feeling of being watched at all times, of being on everybody's mind, it has a name. In psychology, it's called the imaginary audience. Here's how Drew Singel explains this concept. He teaches communication at the University of California, Davis.
There are others out there, unseen others out there, that are thinking about us and judging us at all times. It is a developmental variable, and it's heightened during adolescence because adolescents are somewhat egocentric, so they think that people are thinking about them and judging them at all times.
Think about a time when you were a teen and you hated your off-brand sneakers. Your shirt was too bright, your new haircut too new, or...
If you have a stain on your pants and you go to school, all day you will be thinking that everyone out there in school notices that spot on your pants and is thinking and judging you because you came to school with a spot on your pants.
The man who coined the term imaginary audience in the late 60s is David Elkind, a child psychologist and professor emeritus at Tufts University. Early in his career, he spent a few years working in family courts, and he noticed that kids who got in trouble were often trying to impress a perceived audience. He began to study this, and he found that the notion that others were watching was tied to kids' emotional development.
When adolescents get their new ability to reason, they're able to form abstractions, to think about thinking. It's a second age of reason, if you will. And one of the capacities they have now is to think about other people's thinking.
Adolescents go through rapid changes with their bodies, emotions, roles in the world. They think a lot about themselves. And when they wonder about what others are thinking, they return to themselves and they come to the conclusion, well, they must be thinking what I'm thinking about me. One idea is that this echo chamber of self-obsession is helpful during a time when you craft your own identity. You try out a few different versions of yourself and you're seeking feedback to find your place as your world gets bigger. The imaginary audience tends to be stronger in girls and also in kids with lower self-esteem. It weakens after adolescence, but some aspects of it remain. Elkind is in his 80s now, and he still feels it pop up every once in a while.
Sometimes when I'm on the road and eating in a restaurant, I might drop my fork, a spoon, and so on, and it clanks, and I think everybody's watching me and thinking I'm a klutz. So I think it's ever, whenever we're really in a new social situation, we become especially aware of the audience and how they're thinking about us and so on.
Back in the 60s and 70s, Elkind developed scales to measure the imaginary audience, but he had trouble getting this work published at first.
A lot of the reviewers turned it down because they said it wasn't based on research, it was just my clinical impressions. But the editor published it, and it became one of the most published articles and republished articles at that time, and has generated all kinds of research.
Drew Singel at UC Davis is one of the researchers building on Elkind's work, and his interest has been how the concept of the imaginary audience has changed in our social media world.
Social media is a space where there is an imaginary audience out there, right? We are crafting communication for someone, we're not really sure whom, at any given time.
You could imagine you're posting for all of your followers and friends when really only a few people see what you wrote.
And so you can imagine that if you use social media often and you're continuously thinking about who's out there, who might receive this message, and how to craft the message to put you in the best light that you want to be in, that would embolden our sense of an imaginary audience.
Singel did a recent series of tests with kids between the ages of 12 and 18 and checked how prevalent their imaginary audience was. He asked them questions.
How often you think of being a rock star, or how often you think of people, believe it or not, coming to your funeral.
He found that there was a relationship between social media use and thinking about the imaginary audience. It's a little bit of a chicken and egg question, but basically, the more kids use social media, the more they thought about their imaginary audience. For high school senior Amanda Thu, social media has added another level of stress, of being judged, because her reach with her posts is potentially so much bigger than her high school audience. Like all normal teenage girls, as she puts it, she posts a lot of selfies, but it's not as easy as snapping a picture and putting it online.
So I would take a lot, like maybe 20 in a couple minutes. With different angles, different poses, everything. And then I would edit them with different filters, brightnesses, exposure. And then I would pick like my top five to send to like my five best friends to see which one they think I should post.
Amanda imagines her friends, family members, strangers, they are all checking out those pictures.
How many likes I get on this picture would like determine if I'm pretty or not, or like wow, I'm popular because I have 200-something likes.
Drew Single wants to explore how social media use actually changes the trajectory of adolescent development. He says right now there's a lot of emphasis on understanding what kids are doing online, but not so much investigation of how this is changing them and all of us. I told him about a group of young girls I saw at the beach last year. They spent the entire afternoon posing for selfies. They never went into the water. I asked Single if he thinks we're changing our 3D lives for the 2D world of social media evidence.
I don't think that that is the main point. I think it's still going and doing something is important. Being with friends is important. And if we can happen to get that piece of evidence that we can bring back to show people what we did, that's important. But I still think that the actually doing it and being there is still key.
Child psychologist David Elkind says the internet has created many new ways of seeking approval from real and imaginary audiences.
I must say it's not unique to teenagers. As a writer now with Amazon, I can check on how my books are doing, and I sometimes am on Amazon too often.
And it makes him wish he had more time left to study the phenomenon he described 50 years ago.
I wish now that I were a young man. There's so much to research with kids on, you know, all the media now and touchscreen technology and what it's doing for young children.
When I spoke with Amanda, she was busy getting ready for her prom. She was worried about a lot of things, her hair being perfect. She told me she chose a style called loose, voluminous curls. She was worried about her dress being just right, and she told me sometimes she longs for the days before her audience showed up.
Like maybe kindergarten, and I would just walk into school and people would greet me. I'd be like, okay, cool, now let me just go play now.
She has taken a bit of a break from social media in recent weeks, and she says it has helped her focus on more important things like her college applications and getting those loose, voluminous curls just so.
Oh no, love, you're not alone. You're watching yourself, but you're too unfair. You got your head all tangled up, but a bar can only make you care. Oh no, love, you're not alone. No matter what or who you've been, no matter when or where you've seen, all the nights in the lacerate your brain. I've had my share.
This is The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott, and today we're talking about some of the unseen factors that change our experiences and lives. What helps us make healthy choices when it comes to diet and nutrition? Is it access to fruits and vegetables, taxing soda, better information? As part of the quest to find answers to this billion-dollar question, food labels are getting a makeover by July 2018. The changes involve how the calories are displayed, serving sizes, and added sugar. Health advocates say the changes will allow shoppers to make better decisions. And joining us now to talk more is Brian Wansink. He is director of the Cornell Food and Brand Lab at Cornell University in Ithaca, New York. Brian, thank you so much for being here.
Well, it's great being with you today.
You've spent a lot of your career looking at the impact of design on our waistline. So what do you make of this new food label?
Well, there's a lot of really good aspects for the label. And one of the things that make it better is the readability, and particularly the readability that comes from A, having much larger calorie fonts. Calories are very visible. But the second thing that it does is it also sort of makes the label a little less crowded by eliminating things like vitamin A and vitamin C. So from a readability standpoint, it's actually improved a little bit. I am concerned, though, about some other aspects and how it might influence behavior.
What do you mean?
Well, one thing that it's done is it's changed the serving size of certain items. So to put instead of what manufacturers have usually considered a serving size, they've made the serving sizes bigger so that it reflected what people usually eat, in like a bigger cereal size or bigger serving of ice cream, things like this. But my concern there is that what it does is it raises the norms of what people think is appropriate to eat. So that might be good for somebody who typically would eat a half bowl of cereal, but I'm afraid what it does to the person who usually would just eat a small amount of cereal or a small amount of ice cream, now they say, wait a minute, This is abnormal for me to be eating so little. I need to eat more. That's what it says. And that's my biggest fear.
Brian, they've also changed how sugars are listed. We can now see added sugars. How do you think that will impact consumers' buying choices?
You know, I think there's a lot of good aspects of having done that. But in general, I think it's very few people who look at a label in that level of detail. And I see people in three ways. I see them as nutrition vigilant people who are very concerned with diet and health. On the other end, there's nutrition disinterested people who really just don't care. And in the middle, there's people who are nutrition predisposed. They're a little bit interested, but only if you make it really easy for them. The only people this is going to influence are the people who I think don't need to be influenced. And those are the people who are hypervigilant and really pretty much know a lot of this anyway.
And does information help us get skinny? You talked about a lot of people don't look at labels, don't care about labels. I mean, I know what it takes to lose 20 pounds, and I still haven't lost those 20 pounds. So what helps us make better choices?
Well, people who are very, very attuned and very interested in labels will go and look at the details. But the majority of people actually look at the front of a pack. They might look at one or two of the things in the back, and they make a decision based on one product in a category versus another product. Okay, so for instance, they say, you know, I'm going to buy a granola bar. So they'll compare one brand of granola bar to the other. And if they're interested in calories, they might say, oh, this one has 240 calories, but this other one has 225. I'll take the one with 225. But what they don't do is compare the granola bar with the banana. Okay, because they're essentially looking or shopping what's called within category and not between categories.
So is the design tweak that has to happen perhaps much more related to where food is placed and what we have access to?
You know, that's the three biggest things that influence us. It's the availability, the affordability, and essentially the attractiveness of food. And that's what needs to happen. But the good thing is we're seeing a lot of that happen in grocery stores right now, because the healthier foods tend to be also the foods that have the highest margin for grocers. A grocer makes a lot more money selling apples than Apple Jacks, because apples, if they go bad, they've lost that investment, whereas, you know, breakfast cereal lasts forever almost. And what we see now is retailers being much more conscious about where they place foods, how they sequence them in grocery stores, so that people buy a higher percentage of produce, and usually it's a little bit at the expense of ready-to-eat foods.
Brian, thank you so much.
It's great being with you. Thank you.
Brian Wansink of Cornell University, his book is Slim by Design, Mindless Eating Solutions for Everyday Life.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6.
We got a lot of feedback on a story we ran last week. It was by reporter Sean Hurley. He described his long walk across the country. It was an attempt to escape his struggles with alcoholism. Here's one of the notes we got on our Facebook page. It came from Tracy Kennedy, and she said, I don't know how to comment on this except to say I pulled off the road to listen without any distractions. If you missed this story, make sure you catch it on iTunes. Just look for the Preservation Nation edition of The Pulse. This is The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. You can find our podcast on iTunes. Today, we're exploring some of the unseen factors that change our experiences and behaviors. And there's a scene in To Kill a Mockingbird that speaks to that. It's where Atticus Finch offers young Scout a bit of advice.
You never really understand a person until you consider things from his point of view.
Sir?
Till you climb inside of his skin, walk around in it.
You can't get into somebody else's skin, but you can get pretty close to that experience thanks to new technology. Todd Bookman takes a look at how virtual reality is being used to increase empathy.
The headset kind of looks like a pair of ski goggles with a power cord. It blocks out the real world and ushers in a virtual one. The first thing you see in this 10-minute experience I'm trying out is an apartment, a crummy apartment with crummy furniture. And then a voice explaining that you've just been laid off and you need to sell your couch and TV or you can't make rent. Then the world shifts and you are living in your car. You spin your head and the virtual world spins with you. In the back seat, all your possessions. Suddenly, in the driver's window, there's a flashlight. It's a cop telling you you can't sleep here. On it goes, this first-person look at how someone, really anyone, can become homeless.
We want to see if having this intense, emotionally arousing experience could change the way you think and the way you act towards the homeless.
Elise Ogle of Stanford University helped design this content. It's one of a growing number of virtual reality or VR worlds aimed at changing attitudes and increasing compassion to pulling off that Atticus Finch another man's skin trick. Jeremy Balanson runs Stanford's Virtual Human Interaction Lab, which is researching these social good experiences. He says the reason VR can work like this is because of the deep immersion you get. Put on the headset and you get lost in a way you generally don't when watching a movie or reading a book.
The front of your brain tells you over and over again, this is not real, it can't be real. But the back of your brain, the one that's charged with basic survival, it can't differentiate. And if it looks real, if it sounds real, it treats the experience as real.
This is sound from another VR tool. It's a combat simulation primarily designed for soldiers battling PTSD. Skip Rizzo with the University of Southern California helped develop it. He says it's not just for former soldiers, though. Their family members can also benefit from it.
And it kind of opens their eyes to what it was like for, you know, their loved one to have to go through a wartime conflict. When they're riding in a Humvee and all of a sudden an IED goes off and people start screaming and there's gunfire with tracer firing coming from a building, all in VR, all of a sudden they have, a little bit of a deeper sense of what their loved one has gone through.
You can read about the battle for Fallujah in the Times or watch the opening scene of Saving Private Ryan and get a feel for what war is like. But VR can potentially give a truer experience. Exactly what that experience does for us in terms of emotional processing and learning and behavior change isn't yet fully understood. And it's unclear how long the empathetic response may last.
Well, I mean, we've had, 100 years or so of psychology as a science studying human behavior and interaction in the real world. Now we've got to spend a good bit of time studying how humans behave and interact in the virtual world. So we've got a good bit to go, but I think the research will bear fruit.
Video games may still get most of the investment dollars, but there's clearly a push to use this technology for social good. To that end, the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation recently awarded Stanford a $300,000 grant to continue studying its homeless scenario. And the United Nations put money behind what's perhaps the gold standard right now for this type of VR. It's a short film called Clouds Over Sidra, about the life of a 12-year-old girl inside a Syrian refugee camp.
We have to play football quickly because there are so many kids waiting to play. Especially now. Unlike home, here in Zaatari, girls can play football too. That makes us happy.
That project's director, artist Chris Milk, spoke about the potential for the technology during a TED Talk last year.
So, it's a machine. But through this machine, we become more compassionate. We become more empathetic. And we become more connected. And ultimately, we become more human.
More human through shared experience, through stepping into someone else's skin for a while. It all sounds like fiction, but it feels like reality. For The Pulse, I'm Todd Bookman.
You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Maiken Scott, and we're exploring unseen worlds today. And now we're going to hear from a writer who stumbled upon a bit of uncharted territory in science history, a microcosm of women working at NASA starting in the 1940s. They were female mathematicians who helped facilitate some of our greatest triumphs in outer space. Nathalia Holt's new book is called Rise of the Rocket Girls, The Women Who Propelled Us from Missiles to the Moon to Mars. I asked her how she discovered this story.
Well, I came across it in a really unusual way. In 2010, my husband and I were expecting a baby, and we were having a really difficult time coming up with names. We would make these long lists of names, and nothing seemed right. And then finally, my husband suggested Eleanor Francis. And I wasn't sure, and so I did what parents do these days, and I Googled the name. And what popped up was a woman named Eleanor Frances Helene. And there was this beautiful picture of her. It's black and white, and it's taken in the 1960s at NASA where she's accepting an award. And I was just stunned by this picture because I had no idea that women worked at NASA at that time, much less as scientists. So I really wanted to learn more. And what I found is that she wasn't alone. There's actually this large group of women who all worked starting in the 1940s at a place called the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, California.
And what did you find out? What did they actually do at NASA?
So they started out as computers, and this is a weird term. So in those days, a computer actually meant a person who computes. Before all of the digital devices we have today, laboratories would hire computers to do all their calculations for them. And so this group started at JPL doing all of the calculations for early missiles, and it became all women because of one woman whose name was Macy Roberts. And she was made supervisor of the computing section in 1942, and she decided that she was going to hire only women. And her thinking here was that she wanted to create a really cohesive group. She wanted it to feel like a family, and she worried that if she hired men, they just wouldn't get along. They wouldn't listen to her because she was a woman. And so it's because of her, then, that you have this really strong group of women who all working at JPL.
And how did these women find out about this opening in the job market? I'm sure a lot of women during that time assumed that those kinds of jobs were closed off to them.
Yeah, so they found about it in many different ways, but the lab did put out advertisements saying computers wanted. And so one of these women actually is named Jenez Lawson. She was the first African-American hired in a technical position at the lab. And she had a degree, a bachelor's degree in chemical engineering from UCLA. So today she would just be hired as an engineer. But back then she knew that she wouldn't be hired as an engineer because of her gender, because of her race. And so when she saw an advertisement at her school job board for a computer, she knew that this was kind of a way for her to sneak into the engineering world and to still be part of what was happening in aeronautical engineering.
Describe for me the contributions these women made. What was their actual work, and how was it used to eventually get us to the moon?
Their contributions span quite a period of time. They started out by doing all of the calculations by hand using paper and pencil. And these calculations informed our early missiles. They informed the first rockets. They were in the control room during key moments in space history. So they were there during the first American satellite. They were there during our early moon missions, during our early missions to Venus and Mars. And then later on, they did become engineers. And they ended up tracking the trajectory of the Voyagers as they went through the solar system, and one of them, of course, has left the solar system. And they've worked on Mars rovers, just an incredible range of missions. There's hardly a NASA mission you can think of that they have not been part of.
How is NASA looking today in terms of gender balance?
So it's good and bad. What we see is that this year, 2016, is actually the first year we have an astronaut class that is half female. And this is an amazing accomplishment. But on the other side, the number of women employed as engineers at NASA hasn't increased at quite the same pace. So we see that only 23% of engineers are women at NASA, and this is a place we really need to improve upon. It actually goes with the trend of women pursuing technology in the United States. So we're seeing a drop in the number of women getting degrees in computer science. And, you know, my hope through this book is that we can encourage more women to be pursuing technology.
And what did you end up naming your daughter?
Her name is Eleanor Francis. And, you know, it's funny because she shares her name with a woman who unfortunately passed away before I started writing the book. She shares a name with a woman who I've never met, but, you know, whose story I really hope will inspire my Eleanor one day.
Nathalia, thank you so much.
Thank you. I really appreciate it.
Nathalia Holt is a science writer and the author of a new book called Rocket Girls, The Women Who Propelled Us from Missiles to the Moon to Mars. And guess what? Hollywood is getting in on one part of this story. There's a movie called Hidden Figures about the African-American female mathematicians who worked at NASA. It's slated to come out early next year.
Yeah.
You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. 2 years ago, a small nomadic bird called the Rufa redknot became the first bird to make the endangered species list, primarily due to climate change. This is one of the most studied birds in the world because it spends the majority of its life migrating. It was argued that the Rufa were vulnerable to changing temperatures because it could put off their precise biological clock. But researchers who know the Rufa redknot best say the problem is more complicated than that. Reporter Carolina Jaramillo joined the Rufas during an important pit stop on their over 9,000-mile migration.
It's shorebird season in the Delaware Bay.
Everybody here, they're going to move birds and then we'll come out.
It's 7 in the morning on a clear sunny day in mid-May. Thousands of redknots, ruddy turnstones, and sanderlings are fighting for space with local laughing gulls on the shore of North Reeds Beach in Cape May, New Jersey. They're all feasting on horseshoe crab eggs, the house specialty. A team of international experts is here to catch and measure the remarkable Rufa redknot, a bird the size of an iPhone 6 with a red cinnamon chest that travels every winter from the Canadian Arctic to Tierra del Fuego, the furthest tip of South America, and then back again in spring, making an essential pit stop at the Delaware Bay. Amanda Day, principal zoologist of the New Jersey Department of Environmental Protection, says the geolocators they've been installing on the birds show they don't stop flying for days.
We know how long they were in the air, when they stopped, how long they stopped for, so you can see an actual year's worth of travel distances, and you can see some of these birds that were in the air for 6 days. Or in the air for 8 days, coming straight from Argentina to the Delaware Bay. I mean, it's crazy.
On the beach, some of the researchers begin assembling a 25-yard-long net. Larry Niles, the biologist who's been leading this shorebird project for over 20 years, prepares 3 cannons that will propel the net over the birds.
Now I need to corner the corner.
By 7:45, the net has been set and everything is ready to go. As soon as 200 birds wander into Larry's line of fire, he will activate the net cannon.
What do you think, Happy?
I think we got it.
I think we got a reasonable catch. Lots of birds.
3, 2, 1, fire!
At first sight, the Rufa redknot is not a spectacular bird. What makes the bird special to scientists and birders around the world is the mythology around its epic migration.
I mean, they're the sort of the rock stars of the bird world.
That's Humphrey Sitters, a biologist from the UK. He's been studying and following the shorebirds for 15 years.
They're great travellers, but they don't have passports. They don't belong to any country. They're everybody's birds.
The Rufas arrive in Jersey hungry and tired. To get here, they've burned through their body weight, including stomach muscles, and the only food they can digest are soft, pinhead-sized horseshoe crab eggs. The problem is that there's not enough of them. So only 50% of the red knots get back to an ideal weight for their flight to the Arctic, where they breed. The red knot population went from 80,000 in the 1980s to just 12,000 in 2005. And in the last decade, the changing weather made their situation worse by messing up their finely tuned biological clock. Here's Charles Duncan, a conservation biologist who's been studying shorebirds for years.
As the waters warm through climate change, the crabs may come ashore earlier, and if the birds are not arriving earlier, then the eggs they need won't be there. It's like showing up at the restaurant after it closes.
Experts say that having the RUFA listed in the Endangered Species Act in 2014 helped secure federal funding to restore beaches where horseshoe crabs lay their eggs. But the RUFA's food supply is still at risk. It turns out that a key component in the blood of horseshoe crabs, lysate, is used to detect bacterial toxins in every injectable solution or implantable medical device that enters our body. For that reason, every year, the biomedical industry catches 600,000 crabs and collects one-third of their blood. Each gallon is worth $60,000. And although they release them alive, studies estimate that between 10 to 30% of them die, and many of those remaining can no longer mate. And if all this wasn't enough, scientists also worry that the rising trend of oyster farming will challenge the ability of the crabs to get to the beach and lay their eggs.
So climate change continues to be a threat, but that immediate over-harvesting of horseshoe crabs, in my mind, in the mind of most scientists, is the single driver.
That's Duncan again. Experts say shorebirds used to stop in other places along the Atlantic coast, Virginia, Georgia, North Carolina, Massachusetts. But now they only stop here.
And if the knot can be, if you will, the spokesbird for all of those other ecosystems, then I think we need to pay attention to that message.
But what would happen if there were no more RUFA red knots? Would the rest of the ecosystem collapse?
I don't think we can make that claim, but it sure would be a less rich world that we would be passing on to our children and their children.
For The Pulse, I'm Catalina Jaramillo.
This is The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott, and our show today is about unseen factors that shape our lives. There's a new health fad that involves a clear bag filled with liquid, and that liquid supposedly contains invisible superpowers that will make you feel healthy and strong. Remember those oxygen bars from a few years ago? This new trend involves putting the magic mix right into your veins. Pop singer Rihanna has done it. Actress Sofia Vergara even set up an IV hydration station at her wedding. But is there any science to back this up? Here's Tanya English.
So you saw the waiting room,
yeah.
Obviously.
What do you guys do here?
So right here we have two practices. We have my integrative medical practice called Arcana Health.
Jason Hartman gives me the tour of his Philadelphia practice. Throughout the space, there are hardwood floors and exposed brick, natural light, and green plants. Hartman is a physician, and his specialty is osteopathic medicine, using touch to diagnose and treat. I'm here to see his new business, Restore IV, where he gives people high-dose vitamins with a needle in an intravenous bag.
We have two recliners here. As you can see, the IV pole in between. So
big LCD TV.
Big LCD screen.
How big is that TV?
That is probably about 64 inches.
There's a menu of drips sold to boost immunity or help you detox or turn up your glow. Hartman says people want that experience.
You know, they've heard that Kim Kardashian just got her infusion before the Met Gala for the beauty IV, right?
The basic cocktail includes vitamin C, zinc, B vitamins, and if you have a headache, the doctor might add a little magnesium. Sounds good, except I don't actually know what any of those things do. When someone says vitamin, minerals, antioxidants, amino acid, that all sounds the same to me, and okay, I don't know what a biochemical is, and I don't know why I need a tell me more.
What I like to think of these as is these are your natural pharmacy. And in chronic diseases, these things can be depleted with stress of, you know, just a stressful lifestyle. And if they become deficient enough, it alters your internal pharmacology enough to possibly manifest as a symptom or a disease.
In cities like New Orleans, Las Vegas, even Ibiza, there are infusion places called Hangover Heaven or the Remedy Room that cater to tourists who party hard.
Where they go right into your hotel room and they, you know, they bring a pretty woman for a bachelor party. You know, everyone's hungover. They come in, they do it.
But Jason Hartman cares for people with serious diagnosed illnesses, including chronic fatigue and migraines. For those patients, he says IV treatment supports healing. Other patients are generally healthy and they want to stay that way. Hartman says it's lifestyle management.
Seems like there's a moment happening, right?
Yeah, absolutely. There's definitely a moment happening here. We are a bigger, better, faster culture. I want to be a better me. You want to be a better you. And I think this trend reflects that.
One longtime patient is a Philadelphia attorney with two kids and an exhausting travel schedule at work.
Anything to avoid antibiotics.
Or being out of commission. Or
being out of commission, absolutely.
Yana Shapiro comes in for 100 milligrams of the drip called immunity protection when she wants to prevent a cold.
I have two small kids that bring anything from foot in the mouth to pink eye to colds home periodically.
It takes less than a half hour to get the infusion. And while she waits, the cushy theater seats recline and the room has a dimmer switch.
I take this time as me time to relax and, you know, kick back and close my eyes for a couple of minutes.
All right, so I'm going to put a tourniquet on. We'll make sure you have a good vein. Let's see what things look like.
Before he inserts the butterfly needle in Shapiro's arm, a medical assistant puts on surgical gloves.
And go ahead and sterilize the site.
Like any skin puncture, there's a very small risk of infection or bruising and bleeding if you miss the vein.
All right, so we're getting ready to introduce the needle. You ready? Take a deep breath in. Blow out hard. Good.
And okay. Actually, as I'm getting the IV, I could feel the vitamin C in my mouth.
What does that taste like?
It's that citrusy taste that you feel automatically as the IV goes in.
The treatments cost from $150 to $200. And at Restore IV, everyone pays the doctor's office directly. They don't take insurance.
Is it worth it? It's not cheap.
It is not cheap. It is absolutely worth it for me.
But if you mostly eat your kale and your quinoa, why would you even need a boost of vitamins delivered straight to your bloodstream? Skeptical doctors say that you probably don't. A healthy gut takes in the nutrients that we need. Ather Ali is a research scientist at Yale School of Medicine. If IV infusion makes people feel better, he suspects it's a placebo effect.
You know, when your child falls down, scrapes their knee, and you give them a kiss, I mean, there's value in that.
The phenomenon is more complicated than just giving a patient a dummy sugar tablet. Ali says offering an invasive placebo, like an IV, can have a stronger effect than a pill.
The idea of context and ritual and coming to a doctor and, you know, feeling reassured and paying money.
Ali and some of his colleagues tested an IV treatment called the Myers cocktail on about 30 people with fibromyalgia. That's a syndrome that causes muscle pain and fatigue and can be hard to treat. Half the study participants got IV vitamins. The other half got a saline solution without the vitamins.
And the interesting finding was that everyone got better.
People reported less pain, and they said they were better able to do the things they needed to do every day. Ali says if a treatment is helping someone and there's nothing else available, that may be a reason to use it, even if the fix is 100% placebo effect. But he does not offer high-dose intravenous vitamins in his practice. Ali says he can't ethically recommend the treatment for healthy people.
If people are just using it for to feel good or energy boost, I mean, I would say go exercise for 30 minutes and you'll probably get more out of that.
If you do try it, believers and non-believers say someone should ask about your medical history before the needle goes in. For The Pulse, I'm Tanya English.
You're
You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. Many people who have diabetes have to inject themselves with insulin several times a day. It's a routine that's usually well hidden from others, from their friends, from their coworkers, but it can be uncomfortable and often painful. A Kansas City researcher may have found a way to ease this plight. Alex Smith reports that instead of needles, his method involves piercing the skin with light.
This is my exercise in the evening time.
On a busy league night in Raytown Bowling Alley, retired auto worker Raymond Fowler keeps his game up playing alongside his wife and longtime teammate. The 67-year-old former auto worker stays busy in his retirement, but it's not all fun. A few years ago, he was diagnosed with type 2 diabetes and made a lot of changes to his exercise and diet. His condition was severe enough that his doctor said he needed insulin shots. That's one change he had trouble making.
The insulin, it would burn. When you chewed yourself, it would just sting. And so after a while, I went back and talked to my endocrinologist and told her, I can't keep doing this the rest of my life.
Because insulin is a protein, it can't be taken orally in a pill because the body would try to digest it. Instead, many diabetics have to inject it with a syringe or a pen. The routine can be especially complicated for type 1 diabetics who have to test glucose and adjust insulin levels many times a day. In his lab at the University of Missouri, Kansas City School of Pharmacy, Professor Simon Friedman is working to change how insulin injections work. It's not an area he originally set out to work in.
We were interested in light, actually. It started off with light, and we had quite a few years of developing methods to use light to control other biological processes.
Friedman recently got a grant of nearly $1.5 million from the National Institutes of Health to develop his alternate insulin delivery system. His idea is to create a single injection that would contain lots and lots of individual insulin doses held together in a resin using special molecular bonds that are especially sensitive to light.
They're molecules that do chemistry when you shine light on them. So they're kind of related to the molecules you might find in a recordable CD or a recordable DVD. They undergo photochemistry. Chemistry bonds being made and broken using light.
Light-sensitive bonds have been used in fields like genetics for a few years, but they're new to pharmaceuticals. Here's what Friedman has in mind. A patient would inject the mixture right under the skin and strap an LED light on top of it. When a glucose monitor finds that insulin is needed, the light would shine through the skin and break the link between the resin and the insulin. That would free the drug to enter the bloodstream. And unlike injections spread out over the course of a day, this approach would adjust insulin levels constantly.
That's a nice thing about light control is you can continuously vary light by, you know, second by second. You can change the intensity of a light. You can change the duration of a light that's exposed. And with that, you can get continuously variable changes in release.
Friedman hopes this method will cut down required injections to once every few days, once a week, or possibly every few weeks.
We have to think about the human side. How can we make it easy for patients to be able to use the medication and medication systems?
Mark Perot is a sociology professor who studies quality of life issues for diabetics at Loyola University, Maryland in Baltimore. He says that reducing injections could do a lot to help patients stick with their insulin routines and stay healthy. But he says to get patients on board with the new technology, it has to be simple and streamlined, unlike, say, insulin pumps and inhalable insulin, which haven't really taken off.
Anytime you ask a patient to change from what they're already doing to something else, there's barriers. There's just inertia there. Learning something new, learning about a new device, finding out about it creates a barrier.
The new insulin system may be promising, but Perot sees a couple of wrinkles that may need working out. The light and insulin method is meant to work hand in hand with a constant glucose monitoring system, and that technology isn't quite perfected yet. Even if it is, it would probably have to be worn, along with the light emitter itself, on the outside of the body. And for some, that could be a deal breaker.
Patients also sometimes have concerns that have to do more with, say, cosmetics, things like being concerned what they will look like if they have a device attached to their body.
whatever form it takes, insulin without regular injections can't come soon enough, as far as Raymond Fowler is concerned. Exercise, diet, and oral medications have allowed him to stop taking insulin, but his blood sugar is creeping up again, and now he's facing the possibility of having to start injections all over again. And he confesses he's been putting off some doctor's visits.
That was the reason why at first I didn't want to go back to see her, because I knew she put me back on insulin. And I just couldn't fool with them needles no more.
Dr. Friedman says he'll likely need several more years to perfect the insulin and light technology before it's ready for public use. For The Pulse, I'm Alex Smith.
Alex Smith is a reporter for KCUR's Heartland Health Monitor. That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. Our health and science reporters are Tanya English, Alana Gordon, Todd Bookman, and Irina Zhorov. Charlie Kyer is our engineer, Paige Flager, our associate producer, Joel Patterson, our managing editor, and Megan Pinto, our executive producer. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening. Independence Blue Cross supports WHYY's The Pulse. Independence is coming to your neighborhood to help you understand healthcare options. Licensed agents can help prepare you for whatever may be ahead. Learn more at ibx.com/events. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless. Ben Franklin Technology Partners of Southeastern Pennsylvania supports WHYY's The Pulse and are partners with a purpose, providing capital, counsel, and connections to technology entrepreneurs and investors in the greater Philadelphia area. More about Ben at partnerswithapurpose.org. Next week on The Pulse, we'll dig into a dark chapter of medical history.
He sees across the yard a table with his friend's naked body on it. And the doctor, the prison physician, is working on him.
This story involves a legendary horse thief and a desperate need for bodies. Don't miss that episode of The Pulse. Subscribe to our podcast on iTunes.